Well, it really is very good to be here, and one of the joys for me in travelling around the place is meeting people. So I'm glad we're here for quite a few hours, and I look forward to meeting many of you during the breaks and morning tea and so on. This is the talk where there's most material I'm trying to pack in, so we'll keep going till morning tea, and I don't know whether we'll even finish then, but fear not. The other talks, I think they'll be slightly less rushed. And there will be plenty of time for questions. I'm conscious in a subject like this, even with three sessions of speaking and one question time, there's an awful lot that we are not going to be able to engage with. So if you've got questions, just be jotting them down. There probably won't be time at the end of the first session, but there'll certainly be time when we get to questions. I'm conscious, as I speak about this, we're not just talking about some sort of dry academic subject. As Dave said at the beginning, this is a very personal subject, and it brings into our thoughts and our hearts a whole mix of different feelings, and not just some people feeling joy and other people feeling hurt or shame. It's a whole mix in all of us. We are all, very obviously, sexual beings, and we bring to this subject different sexual histories, different sexual desires, different circumstances, whether single, married, happily married, unhappily married, it's a good time now, it's a hard time now, divorced, bereaved. And I also want to say right at the beginning, we are, of course, all not just sexual beings, but all sexual sinners. And we will be thinking quite a bit about the world and how the world thinks about this subject and how the world may live. And yet I take it as read, we're not looking at the world with any sense of judgmentalism. We might disagree with the way that the world thinks. We might disagree with the way that some in the world live. But we are sexual sinners. And because of that, I'm conscious I will touch on raw nerves as I go along. I do not mean to do so. And if I touch on something that is very personal for you, and it doesn't sound as if I'm being as sensitive as I should be, all I can say is I'm sorry in advance. I certainly don't mean to do that. We will move through subjects pretty quickly. And if I touch a raw nerve, please do forgive me. Not only personal, but also controversial. Because our culture clearly takes a different view to the Orthodox Christian position. Things have changed very dramatically in the Western world and beyond in the subject of sexual morality and behavior in the last 50 years or so. 1960, I'm giving British dates, but they'll be very similar to Australia. 1960, the pill was introduced. In Britain, 1967, the legalization of abortion. And those two realities together accelerated a disconnection between sex and childbirth and sex and marriage. And so now the statistics are very clear, and they accelerated dramatically. They've now, to some degree, flattened, but people had sex earlier and earlier with more and more partners. Cohabitation has increased dramatically, divorce increased dramatically, and marriage increasingly being redefined, whether legally or just in the way people think about it. In Britain, of course, marriage has been redefined or extended, depending on your point of view. It is one of the most dramatic cultural revolutions in history. And in just 50 years or so, 60 years ago, it has swept almost everyone along with it. What were radical views a few years ago have now entered the cultural mainstream. And it's believed in the culture at large, certainly amongst younger people, that only a few relics from a bygone age stick to the old traditional morality, the Christian view that sex is for the marriage of one man and one woman, seen increasingly as eccentric, and not only as eccentric, perhaps actually dangerous, because Freud taught us that repression of any kind is a dangerous thing. And so not only are you a bit of a fuddy-duddy, old-fashioned, but you're actually going to ruin people's lives and cause them grave problems. I remember watching an afternoon television show, and there was a discussion program about sexual morality, and one Christian couple got up and said that they were students, they were engaged to be married, but they were not having sex until they got married. And the outrage was extraordinary. And one of the panelists, who was a pseudo-psychologist, you know, expert there, she said, "You are storing up big problems for yourselves in the future." So not only were we regarded as relics, but in some circles we're regarded as rather dangerous. What we're dealing with here is not simply two different moralities. Those moralities flow from two very different worldviews. Both claim to offer good news, freedom and fulfillment. And the question is, which is right? I think it's really helpful, if we're going to engage with the world, to engage not simply on the level of morality and behavior, but also on the level of worldview. Both are offering freedom and fulfillment. Which is right? And I want us to get on the front foot in this area, because I think what we've got to offer is manifestly good. Most people in our culture today think that in restricting sex to marriage, the Bible is restrictive, it's repressive, and it is the permissive society that brings liberation and life. And many Christians have been swayed by that. So that in the case of liberal Christians, they change their morality. Or sadly, in the case of a number of conservative Christians, they're compromised. So that they say they believe one thing, but behave in a very different way. And the reason they behave in a very different way is because they're not convinced that God's ways are good. Well, we're going to look more deeply at the Bible, and we see first and foremost what it contains is not laws. The Bible is a story, it's a true story, the true story, and it's a love story about a God who made us, who loves us, and wants the best for us. We turn from him and his ways. He wants us back, and so he sends his Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. He comes as the divine lover, offering us marriage, and we'll see more of that later. God's commands in the Bible are never arbitrary. They flow from his love, they fit with his design of us, creation, and his destiny for us, which is where we're heading. You can't decide what leads to freedom and fulfillment without considering those two key issues of design and destiny, or to put it another way, identity and purpose. Who are we and what are we for? Those questions are not being asked very often by our contemporary culture. And when we're dealing with not just sex, but really any issue, it's worth raising the issue of worldview. What do you think a human being is? Who are we? What are we for? If we truly grasp the Bible's answers, we'll understand that what the Bible is teaching is not just right, but it is very, very good. Let's think for a moment about sex and marriage in the I world. I take that title from a book by Dale Kuhn called Sex and the I World. I hope it'll become clear why he uses that title. Steve Jobs was a genius, not just in creating great products, but behind that, just a genius in marketing. He got the contemporary world. He understood the zeitgeist, if you like, the spirit of the age. And he captured it in the names of his products. The iMac, the iPod, the iMac. We live in the I world. Everything revolves around the individual. And the roots of the sexual revolution go back long before cheap and effective methods of contraception. The roots of this revolution go back to when Western philosophers questioned the concept of objective truth, at least in the realm of meaning and morality. Either there is no such thing as objective meaning and objective morality, or we just can't ever access it. So even if it's out there, the best we can do is guess what meaning is and what morality is. That almost inevitably leads to individualism. If there are no fixed values, if at the very most I can do is guess what might be right about what the world is for and how I should live, then no one has the right to impose values on you, because all they're doing is saying that, well, this is my guess. It's the height of arrogance to impose your guess on someone else. And so, almost inevitably, that led to individualism and the primacy of self-expression. I must make my own decisions about how I'm going to live and what I think is right in the world. And so what we got in our culture is the freedom to adopt just about any values, as long as you don't think that they're true, because then you're likely to violate the fundamental value, which is the freedom of self-expression. The advertisers get it. And if you want to understand a culture, look at the adverts, because that's what advertisers are being paid a fortune to do, to get the culture and speak into it. PlayStation. Be whatever you want to be. Burger King. Have it your way. Nike. Just do it. That's the I world. Blaze your own trail, create your own identity, fulfill your own dreams. And the I world leads, not surprisingly, to I sex. I'm free to define myself. For example, bisexuality. I'm free to recreate myself, even to change my gender. I'm free to decide how I live sexually. The student union at Oxford University produced a safe sex leaflet, which it gave to all new students not long ago. It said, sleep with whoever you want, whenever you want, but do it safely. And there you've got the morality of our age. Do it safely. But apart from that, it's up to you. The only other rule that's zealously guarded is that no one has the right to criticize someone else's life choices or behavior. That is immoral. That is a taboo. It's about the only taboo left. Sex in the I world is about me. It's about satisfying my desires, satisfying my appetite, improving my performance. The other person is almost incidental. Sex becomes just a bodily appetite. You're hungry? Have a burger. You're thirsty? Have a Coke. You're turned on? Have sex. It's just a physical thing. It's just a bodily appetite. And porn, of course, is the epitome of I sex. The individual in control, getting what he or she, it's important to remember that, increasingly porn is an issue for men and women, whatever he or she wants, there's a sense of entitlement. And the other person is dehumanized, just a body on a screen. That attitude is not limited to porn. C.S. Lewis wrote about a lustful man prowling the streets. He said, we say he wants a woman. He doesn't. He wants a pleasure for which a woman happens to be the necessary piece of apparatus. That's I-sex. Dehumanizing. Both for the one who's used in that way, whether on a screen or in bed, and dehumanizing for the user. And it does not satisfy. Because the sexual desire is a profoundly relational desire. It's not just desire for a pleasure. Which is why this kind of dehumanized sex is so addictive, because it never satisfies. It always demands more. And so it's no surprise that in our pastoral dealings and amongst ourselves, we're finding increasing addiction patterns in these areas. So in the I world, sex is degraded. That's what I'm talking about. It just becomes a bodily thing. It's about me. But perversely and bizarrely, it's not only degraded on the one hand, on the other hand, it's deified. Here's Lewis again. So often, he gets it right ahead of his time. Lewis said, sex is rapidly becoming the one thing venerated in a world without veneration. to get rid of God, there's still this transcendent longing in human beings. And where do we find it? Well, sex takes us out of ourselves. Romance takes us out of ourselves. And so there's a kind of deification of sex, an idolatry of eros. Finding relationship and sexual fulfillment for many people in our culture becomes the key to happiness. So you've got to be in a sexual relationship, because without sex, there's no intimacy, there's no fulfillment. What is the legacy of sex in the I world? Does it bring the freedom and fulfillment it promises? Well, absolutely not. I sex leads to I marriage. In the I world, marriage is redefined. In traditional society, marriage is understood as a public relationship of mutual obligation to one another, to the family, and to wider society. It is fundamental to the social fabric. Marriage has huge emphasis on duty, fulfilling duty. But then in the I world, marriage is individualized, it's privatized. It's about two individuals. It's got little to do with anyone else, really. It's about two individuals looking to fulfill themselves and seeking to find in the other their emotional and sexual needs. It's based not so much on duty and obligation as on feeling. Well, inevitably, the result is that marriage is undermined. There's very little commitment. If relationship is based on feelings, well, what does a piece of paper add anyway? So why bother to get married? If it's about a feeling, this doesn't add anything. Anyway, there's a danger that if we go and get our bit of paper, we'll turn our passion into a prison. So marriage rates, certainly in Britain, I wouldn't be surprised if it's true in Australia, certainly in Britain, marriage rates are declining. We don't like to commit to anyone, because the individual's got to be free, and commitment to anyone else is reducing that freedom. Autonomy is the key in the I world. And so we're finding increasing numbers looking to no strings attached sexual relationships. The internet and apps on phones have accelerated this dramatically. It's just easy to get on to some online app and find someone else who's looking for no strings attached relationships. It's a massive thing. And there are now apps that overtly advertise to married people for no strings attached relationships within marriage. For the sake of the marriage, it'll spice up your life and make it easier for you to continue in a difficult marriage and so on. And these things are massive. Massive. And if we don't realize how big they are, we don't know what's going on in our society. So there's either no commitment, or there's a semi-commitment, cohabitation, which demands much, but offers no security. Very easy, of course, in a cohabiting relationship for the partner to leave. But the pain can be as great as a divorce. The myth is that, oh, well, it's a trial marriage, we need to find out if we're compatible. But even those who do go on to get married are up to 50% more likely to divorce. It just doesn't work as a trial for marriage. The I world's understanding of marriage leads not only to fewer people getting married, but it undermines the chances of successful marriage if people do tie the knot. Because of this focus on the individual, broken commitments are much more common. Each individual places impossibly high expectations on the other. If you come to marriage as a consumer, then you will think that my spouse is there to fulfill me. And if I'm getting more than I'm getting, and I think I'll get more somewhere else, either on my own or with another spouse, then, so the language goes increasingly, I owe it to myself to get out. Because personal authenticity and fulfilling yourself is the great value. So I can think of one celebrity couple in the UK, and they were both married to other partners. There were kids with both, but then they fell in love with each other. And they gave an interview, and they said it's very inconvenient what's happened to us, and it's terrible, especially because there are kids involved. But we had to be true to ourselves, as if this was unquestioned. Of course they did. You're getting others who are, I can think of one, came out as gay, had been married for many years, there were kids involved, came out as gay, and the culture was not allowed to question that, because you've got to be true to yourself. And or now you've discovered yourself, you've got to be true to yourself. And so it's all about me and my autonomy and being true to myself, rather than the traditional view, duty, obligation, commitment. So once again, what's the legacy of sex in the I world? There's been huge collateral damage as individuals have pursued their personal goals. What's the result? Well, in society, the collapse increasingly of the family unit. And so we find parents struggling to bring up kids on their own. And the impact is not just on parents, but on kids, not being raised by parents and coping with split families, grandparents, and the wider family. There's a huge cost for them. And not if dads are complaining, or sometimes mums, that they don't have the access they want, what about the wider family? But also society, limited, if only, to the financial cost. And it's massive. It's estimated in Britain that the financial cost of family breakdown is somewhere between 20 and 24 billion pounds per annum. And we can't afford it as a society. In traditional society, I've just been to Singapore, and there's very little money put into care for the elderly in Singapore because families care for the elderly. There's a huge sense of family solidarity and duty and commitment. But as families break down, so what marriage does with a husband and wife, and it's intergenerational, because you've got kids and grandparents and so on. There's a sense intergenerationally of connecting rather than just two people who come and go. When that breaks down, how will our societies pay for it, especially with aging populations, let alone the emotional, psychological costs and so on? Well, I've said quite a lot about sex and marriage in the I world because I don't want us to be on the back foot and to kind of think, oh, well, we're stuck with these rather restricted laws and we've got to keep them because we believe in the Bible, but it's a bit miserable. The alternative is destroying individuals and families and society. What about sex and marriage in the garden? The Garden of Eden. In other words, God's design for marriage in creation. Well, straight away, in Genesis 1, it becomes clear that God creates men and women as sexual beings. God created, 1:27, mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. And very early on, you have two surprising commands. I wonder if people would guess, if there was a little quiz, what's the first command in the Bible? I don't think many would say the first command in the Bible is to have sex. But it is. Genesis 1:28. Be fruitful and increase in number. Now, where are we? I've got the wrong bit, haven't I? Yeah, there it is. Thank you. Be fruitful and increase in number. You try and being fruitful and increasing number without having sex. Very hard to do unless you're an amoeba. They just divide. So God is saying right at the beginning, procreate, have sex, be fruitful, increase in number. Not many people would guess that. There's no prudishness in the Bible about sex. And not many people would think that the first words to Adam in the garden are these, chapter 2, verse 16, you are free. God is not trying to enslave us. What you have in God's instructions to Adam and Eve is a liberal permission with a single prohibition. 2:16, you're free to eat from any tree in the garden, but you must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for when you eat of it, you will surely die. Of course, the devil corrupts it and says to Eve God is trying to stop them eating any of the tree in the garden. God never said, don't eat from any tree in the garden. God said, eat from any tree except one. It's a liberal permission with a single prohibition. The fundamental disagreement we're finding here between the I world and the Bible is about freedom. The I world resents any restraints. No one has the right to tell us how to live our lives. But in the Bible, true freedom is not found in the absence of all restraint, but living in the light of who we are, creatures made by a loving God. Here's Dale Kuhn in that book, Sex in the I World, or Sex and the I World. He says, like a computer, humans come fully loaded with an operating system that is hardwired into the mechanism. We may do things that damage the hardware or bypass the application system, but we can't replace the operating system. In other words, we only find freedom when we recognize that reality and live accordingly. When we live according to our nature and our design. And there, I think, is another front foot issue when we're talking with people. Because it sounds wonderfully liberating to be free to do what you like. But actually, it's really liberating to know that we haven't just emerged by accident from the cosmic soup. That we're people with meaning and purpose. Well, you're free to do whatever you like because there's no givenness. Well, you're lost. You're adrift in a sea of relativity. You don't know who you are. You don't know where you're going. But we know who we are. We've been made by a loving God. And He's created us in a particular way. And so just as natural laws are hardwired into the way the world is, so the moral law is hardwired into the way the world is. You see someone going to the top of a high building and he's about to jump and you say, no, don't jump. And he says, it's fine because I can fly. And you say, no, you can't fly. There's such a thing as gravity. And he says, oh, I'm not the gravitational type. You say, you're mad. You're trying to live against reality. It's the same with morality. If we try and live away from the way that God has designed us, there will be consequences. Life is not random, and that is great news. In Genesis 2, God introduces His design for sex and marriage. Adam alone in the garden, verse 18, is not good. It's the first thing that's not good. And He creates Eve, and He's thrilled. And out comes of His mouth the first love song, verse 23. This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. He speaks in poetry. He's thrilled. It's a perfect match. And having created the perfect match of a man and a woman, the same human and yet different, male, female, God then institutes marriage. And here we have the Bible's definition of marriage in chapter 2, verse 24, as you know, quoted by the Lord Jesus and by the Apostle Paul. That's why a man leaves his father and mother and is united to his wife, and they become one flesh. So marriage is not just a human institution. It's God's idea. And as I've jotted down on your notes, marriage is the exclusive, covenantal, sexual relationship of a man and a woman for life in the service of God. It's exclusive. A new social relationship is established, marked in different cultures in different ways. It is the primary human relationship. Leave the father and mother and be united to his wife. The assumption is before marriage, the chief social relationship is within the family of birth. But then at marriage, there's a leaving going on. Doesn't mean to say there's no ongoing relationship with mother and father, that's still to be honored and loved and so on. But the primary social relationship is now with the wife and a new family. A new social unit has been established, and it's public. Now, different societies will mark that in different ways. You might have a society where families live together in an extended unit. Let's imagine a big tent, and the family lives in a tent, and then a man leaves that tent, and a woman leaves her tent, and they set up a new tent. It's public. Everyone can see. Oh, there's a new tent. There's a new family. It doesn't need a church service. But it's a public commitment. It's not something they're slinking off. Everyone knows. Different societies mark that in different ways. There's a leaving going on, which means a change in relationship with parents, which is important to get. But parents really do let their kids go. That the new husband and wife aren't forever tied to the parents, but are forming that new relationship. There to be no pseudo-spouses. Work. Golf. And so easily other things get in the way of the primacy of this new relationship. It's exclusive. Next is covenantal. In other words, it's based ultimately not on feelings, but on commitment. Four Weddings and a Funeral came out, 20 years ago or so, and the theme song by the band Wet, Wet, Wet had a line in it which was very striking. You know I love you, I always will, my mind's made up by the way that I feel. Now that completely undermines, those last few words completely undermine the beginning. You're telling me you will always love me, and I'm feeling confident, but then as soon as you tell me you'll always love me because your mind's made up by the way that you feel, my security's gone. Because I know feelings, and they come and go, and they come and go. So what happens when you don't feel so much love for me in a few months' time or a few years' time? You'll just walk away. What happens when you fall in love with someone else? That's not a bad marriage guidance question or preparing people for marriage, by the way. One friend of mine always says to a couple, what are you going to do when you fall in love with someone else? And they look horrified in many cases. Because it happens. And our culture can easily say, well, you've got to accept reality. Because marriage is based on feelings of love. And you used to feel love to your wife, but now you feel love to someone else, and you've got to accept reality, it's time to marry someone else. But the Bible's saying marriage is not based on feelings, it's based on commitment. In the marriage promise, we're not saying all these promises for as long as we both shall love, but as long as we both shall live. And that's hard at times. What did you expect? A great title for a book about marriage by Paul Tripp. What did you expect? Of course it's hard at times. You've got a sinful person coming together in covenant commitment to another single person. But what's going to sustain you through the difficulty of being married to a sinful person is not always your feelings of love. Marriage will sustain your love, not vice versa. Tim and Kathy Keller, in their book on marriage, quote a study, or a number of studies, that show that about two-thirds of marriages that describe themselves as really unhappy will be happy within 5 years, if there's perseverance. It's very common for people to have a difficult time, sometimes early on in marriage, and that they're not expecting it. And it's very difficult. And they're thinking, what have we done? Did we make the right choice? But because they made the promises, they're being encouraged to look in, look in, look in. And then 5 years later, God willing, they're looking back and thinking, oh yeah, we're in a good place. Or it might be later in marriage to persevere. Those promises sustain people and couples through the changes of life and changes of person. One man wrote this. He said, my wife has lived with at least 5 different men since we were married. And each of the 5 was me. We change. I look back to the man I was when I was 21, 25, and I think, wow, I've changed so much since then. But marriage sustains through that time. It's covenantal. And it's a reflection of the marriage of Christ and his church, which is the great covenantal relationship based on absolute commitment. Those great words of Ephesians 5, 31 and 32. This is a profound mystery, but he's just quoted Genesis 2:24. This is a profound mystery, but I'm talking about Christ and the church. Amazing. In other words, the fundamental marriage is the marriage of Christ and his church, and human marriage is a reflection of that, not the other way around. Not as if the fundamental marriage is the marriage of a man and a woman, and then we use that as an illustration and say, well, marriage, the relation of Christ and his church is a little bit like that. It's the other way around. The fundamental marriage is that of Christ and his church. From eternity, God chose a bride for his son. He bound himself by covenant promise, and he's determined to keep it. Christ came as the bridegroom. He left his heavenly father. He died on a cross, so that it might be possible for us to be united to him. And once we're united to Christ by his Spirit, he says, I will never leave you nor forsake you. And God always keeps his promises. Covenantal. Next, it's sexual. The two will become one flesh. We're familiar with the concept of body language. You shake someone's hand, it's an expression of friendship. You kiss them on the cheek, it's an expression of affection. You have sex with them, it is an expression of lifelong commitment. At least it's meant to be. In God's design, as a man and a woman are naked and are joined together, in God's design, what they're saying is, I love you and I'm absolutely committed to you for life. If you're not prepared to say that to someone with your words in public, don't say it with your body. So I say to our young folk, if you love someone, don't take them to bed, take them up the aisle. And then it's appropriate to express your lifelong commitment to them in marriage. Marriage is a sexual union. And so, we haven't got time to look at all these passages, but 1 Corinthians 7, you remember, Paul says, maintain your sexual relationship. There were those who were saying, it seems behind 1 Corinthians, there were those who were saying, the really spiritual people don't have anything to do with sex, because that's sort of bodily and earthy, and spiritual people don't do that. And so the really spiritual people don't get married, they don't have sex, they're single. And those who are married express their spirituality by pulling apart and not having sex together. And Paul is saying, you haven't understood the gift. There are different gifts. We'll come back to this afternoon. And marriage is a gift. So some people have the gift of singleness and they don't have sex. But others have the gift of marriage, and you should have sex because marriage is a sexual union. Don't deprive one another except for a brief season to focus on prayer. Which is why those of us who are pastors, we do need to touch on this kind of subject. I'm not married. I'm not going to be the greatest sex counselor for married couples. But I can at least say, how's this going in your marriage? If I speak to, and I'll say the same to you. Because marriage is a sexual union. So keep having sex. And if this is an issue, if this is an area that's tricky and you don't quite know how to raise it, well, just to say to your husband and your wife, oh, about that talk, and take you from there. Sexual union. Of one man and one woman, that's the next. We'll really come back to this when we think about same-sex marriage after morning tea. I'm saying it's heterosexual, not homosexual. Come back to that. But one man and one woman also means not polygamous. And you might say, well, hang on, aren't there polygamous marriages in the Bible? Yes, there are. The Bible describes lots of things. But when you find things described in narrative, it doesn't mean to say that they're condoned. And when you look at the narrative, you'll find again and again what a mess flows from these polygamous marriages. But the Bible's design comes in Genesis 2:24. One man and one woman for life. For life. Jesus quotes Genesis 2:24 in Matthew 19. And then he continues, so that the two become one flesh, so they're no longer two, but one. Therefore, what God has joined together, let man not separate. God hates divorce. He allows it in the Old Testament as a concession for sin, but never likes it. It's permitted in the New Testament, explicitly, when there's been sexual immorality, when there's been desertion, 1 Corinthians 7. And no doubt there are other very sad circumstances where it may well be right for a couple to separate. For instance, if there's been physical abuse, there's been a danger to the kids or to the spouse. But this is not something that is to be taken lightly. In God's design, marriage is for life. It reflects the absolute commitment of Christ to his church. Marriage, the exclusive, covenantal, sexual union of one man and one woman for life in the service of God. Just a moment on that. John Gray's book, do you remember that? Men are from Mars, Women are from Venus. It was a publishing sensation of 15 years ago or so. The subtitle was this: A Practical Guide for Getting What You Want in Relationships. Which speaks to our time, doesn't it? But in the Bible, marriage is about service. Not about getting what you want from a relationship. But it's about serving one another. And so in Ephesians 5, the wife is encouraged to submit to her husband as the church submits to Christ. And of course the husband is to love his wife as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. It's about mutual giving and costly giving. So it's service of one another, but above all, of God. There's a partnership going on. Genesis 1:28. Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea. There's the cultural mandate. There's the job that human beings are given at creation. And then in Genesis 2:18, it's not good for the man to be alone. I'll make a helper suitable for him. We just assume that Adam's problem is loneliness. Well, no doubt that's part of it, but it's not explicitly mentioned. I take it in the context of Genesis, the big problem is Adam doesn't have a partner to do the work that God has called him to do, which is to subdue the created order. And so Eve is created as a helper, a partner, so that together they engage in this great work of ruling the created order and of partly doing that through having kids and procreation. And so Christopher Ashe, in his book on marriage, has as his subtitle, Sex in the Service of God. And so we're thinking as a married couple, not just how can we meet each other's needs, but how can we together serve God and serve his purposes in the world. And that's why a Christian needs to marry a Christian, so that together they can serve him. And part of that, of course, will be in procreation. I'm touching on so much so quickly. I hope we'll be able to draw more of this out in questions. There's an expectation that a couple will want to have children. Contraception, entirely appropriate. I think the Catholics are wrong that they argue from natural law and say that sex must be open to having kids. But in the Bible, sex is for relationship and reproduction. And so it's not a sinful thing if it's not open in every individual instance to the possibility of procreation. But I think the old way in which contraception is spoken about, family planning, is right. That it's not just to prevent any kids, unless there are particular reasons why that might not be wise, but for all sorts of reasons. But family planning There's an expectation that parents will want to have children, couples rather, will want to have children. We need, of course, whenever we speak on this subject, to recognize that some long for this gift of children, some long for the opportunity to serve God in this way, by raising children in the ways of Christ, that they might serve Him in the world, but is not happening. And it never happens. And that is a very deep and unique pain, and very often a hidden pain. As someone's put it, it's that strange grief which has no focus for its tears and no object for its love. And God understands that. And we need to encourage people, as I encourage you, to take the pain to Him for comfort. And recognize that when there's no children, a marriage can still be wonderfully fruitful. And the one way in which a couple can be fruitful is through having kids, but there are other ways in which together they can serve the Lord in a fruitful way, just as single people can serve the Lord in a creative and fruitful way. We've got to draw to an end. We've thought a little bit about sex, marriage, and the garden. Just quickly as we close before morning tea, sex, marriage, and the gospel. I want to end where we began. How do we feel when we think about these things? And there'll be a mixture of thoughts and feelings. Thanksgiving, frustration, longing, shame, guilt, sadness. And the gospel of Christ speaks into all those feelings and thoughts. You might say that the Bible is a book about marriage. Second chapter of the Bible, the first marriage. Penultimate chapter of the Bible, the marriage of Christ and His church. Marriage on earth is where it begins. Marriage in eternity is where it concludes. And along the way, the Bible's saying, Mark 12:25, there's no marriage, human marriage, in eternity. The fundamental marriage is the marriage of Christ and His church. We are designed to live in a marriage with God. We've turned away. And there's a hole. And that's a longing for a relationship with Him. And we try and plug it with all sorts of different things. Money, possessions, success, relationships. And none of them satisfy. So absolutely, human relationships and marriage are really good gifts of God. But even the best human relationship will not satisfy. And the tragedy is that many people look to sex and relationships to satisfy the hole within, and it rots them up. For those who are not married, it rots them up. They think life's not worth living because I haven't got what I most want in life. But those who come to marriage with the attitude that nothing is more important in life than marriage really undermine their chances of having a good marriage. Makes it much harder. If there's nothing more important than having the perfect marriage, you will react very, very strongly, too strongly, to faults in your husband or wife because they've got to be perfect. You'll forever be expecting declarations of love. They'll never be quite enough. You'll be emotionally manipulative, constantly sensitive, overreacting to things. It's a very different thing when you recognize that Christ is offering the deep marriage and relationship that we all long for. A marriage that's made possible by His death for us on the cross, where He died for all our sins, including all our sexual sins, every sin dealt with. And the result is that in Christ, we are united to Him. And we have a relationship of intimacy with the God who loves us. And He's promised us, I will never leave you nor forsake you. And that is the relationship in which we've got absolute security, from which we're able not to come to our human relationships looking to receive all the time because I'm insecure and I need your love, but we receive so much from Christ, we're able to give, we're able to be gracious, we're able to forgive our husband or wife for not being the perfect husband or wife. we're able to channel love not only to them, but to everyone. And along the way, to find the resources to flee from sin, including sexual sin, and to pursue holiness while we wait for that wonderful time when Christ returns. In Revelation 21, the New Jerusalem comes down out of heaven from God, and the bride is united with the bridegroom. And then at last, the tears wiped away, and all our longings completely fulfilled.